Well, the book is, you just mentioned having it all, and I'm just explaining what a mouse burger is, which I call myself and people who are somewhat like me. Mouse burgers are people who are not prepossessing, not pretty, don't have a particularly high IQ, decent education, good family background, or other noticeable assets, and they can come a long way in life if they apply themselves. I'm a mouse burger, and I have applied. From a problem-ripe youth in Little Rock, Osage, and Green Forest, Arkansas, those last two are tiny Ozark Mountain villages, through 17 secretarial jobs in Los Angeles, my present job at Cosmo in New York, I have applied almost daily. It occurs to me that if you are also a mouse burger who would like to apply, perhaps I can help. The rewards grow through the years. In my 59th year, as I write these words, I shall have to tell you there are days of the most exciting love with a man that's the newest and sexiest that I've ever known, and so forth and so forth and so forth. I'm just establishing my credentials to tell anybody else what he or she might want to do in life to get from a problem-ripe youth or young womanhood or even middle womanhood to a better kind of life. It happened to me, and it can happen to you.
Why do you think of yourself as a mouse burger, as you put it?
Well, I mentioned that that person is not particularly pretty or prepossessing or full of pulchritude or family money or no particular assets of any kind. And I'm still a mouse burger. It's just that mouse burgers can get along pretty well and they can get to be better looking and less shy and they can have success in life. Everybody doesn't start out with the same things going for him or her, but you make up for those things as you go along.
You're obviously addressing your new book to women whose self-images of being kind of plain and not especially extraordinary in any way. One thing I've always wondered is why women with a self-image like that would want to read, for instance, Cosmopolitan, which features so many photographs of really glamorous, gorgeous women in high fashion with, you know, really dressy makeup. Because when you compare yourself, you always come off feeling even more ordinary than you did when you started.
I don't think that needs to be true. The message in Cosmo is absolutely on the line every time that you can be more wonderful and you can certainly get further along than you are. We always have beautiful pictures in Cosmo because they're prettier to look at and they're glamorous and interesting and alive, and it's a stringent rule around there that we do use pretty girls. But you should see some of our cover models before they come in to be photographed. They don't look like they do on the cover of Cosmo. They're quite average looking before the day begins. The message of Cosmo, the written word, has to do with hopefulness and inspiration and helpfulness. And no matter who you are and where you began, you can look better, sound better, feel better, and get on with it.
If even the models are average-looking without the makeup on, might we all be better off if they were photographed looking average and then average people wouldn't feel bad in comparison?
We do that rather frequently. I would say two or three times a year we show some of the most famous models in New York without their makeup, and then we do the complete, reincarnation, but the metamorphosis takes place, and we show them afterwards, and it's really quite staggering.
But the point there is always that you too can make yourself up to look like a transformed person.
The question is, does anybody want to? Is it worth it? Why should you go to all that trouble? It is a lot of trouble to put your makeup on. Well, you don't do it every day and every minute. You may not even do it to go to work every day, but once in a while, it's marvelous to see where you can come from and how much better you can look if you do all those things. And I think it's fun. I wouldn't want to do without it. I don't want to do it all the time. But I think it's wonderful to be able to create this metamorphosis in your very own self, working with no other raw material except yourself and a few cosmetics.
In your new book, Having It All, you give women advice and suggestions not only on business life and behavior in the office, but also things like makeup and personal image. What are some of the things you've done in your own life with your own image to be more glamorous?
Terry, you use the word image. It isn't a word I use very often. My basic premise is that we all start with certain raw material, our brain that we were given with and our looks which we were given with and a certain amount of drive which some of us have more of than others. And I simply say, you don't need anything better than what you've got. Whatever is there can be developed to a really staggering degree. It doesn't happen when you're 18 or when you're 20, but if you keep at it and just work with what's there, you can look a lot better and feel a lot better. So image is never in my head at all. I'm just thinking, I'm average looking. How can I be a little more glamorous? And as we all know from my talking about it so much and in the book, Having It All, I have had my nose reconstructed, and that's okay. Everybody should do that. If she or he has a terrible nose, why not? And I've had a few other things done because I'm moving along and a little older than I used to be. Not a facelift, no, but certain other procedures that a dermatologist can create for you. And that's all very good and honorable. Okay, that's how you look. And more important, much more important, is what you do with your brain, what you do with your intelligence and with your work. And I say you can start very tiny, as I did. And if you keep at it, there is something you can do to be successful. It doesn't have to be being a secretary, which I was, but something. You can arrange flowers, or you sew beautifully, or you've got great taste, or you cook well, and you can cater, whatever.
Let's talk about looks, though, a little bit more. Since you edit a magazine that is very devoted, at least in part, to how women look, I always wondered, like, if you're dissatisfied with the way you look, you have two choices, really. One is to change your opinion of the norm, to say that the norm should be adjusted to fit me into it, and if it doesn't, who cares? And the other approach is to say, I must change myself to look more towards what you're supposed to look like, or more towards the glamorous image. Changing yourself can range from getting a new set of clothes or using more makeup or fixing your nose or removing wrinkles or something. There's varying degrees of doing that. Now, how do you ask yourself? Because a nose change or removing the wrinkles from under your eyes, which you also had done, entails a lot of pain. And you have to really, I think, want a change pretty drastically to be willing to submit to that amount of pain.
Let's go back to your original idea of discussing whether you should change society so that we don't have to go through those things. And in theory, that is absolutely what we should do. It should not matter if your teeth are crooked or your nose is large or you have deep lines in your face. Society should love you anyway, but it never has been true for millenniums of time. There are standards of beauty. Do we want to do away with those? It's a thought, but I can't imagine living in a world in which there were not standards of beauty, and I'm willing to try to go along with them instead of have anarchy, beauty anarchy, where everybody can look like a toad. Okay, if it is honorable to try to conform to some extent, then I think we do it. And far from that being an onerous burden, I feel that when you try to do these things and succeed to some extent, it gives you quite a lift. I think it's fun to try to look better. Fun is too weak a word. I think it's rewarding to try to look better, and that it is not a terrible, terrible burden. I think death is the pits. I think old age is not so terribly wonderful. And one fights back against dying too soon or being old before you're old.
What would be wrong with beauty anarchy, as you referred to it?
It means that we'd all go running around looking very scruffy. We probably would not smell very good. We wouldn't use antiperspirants. We wouldn't wash our hair. We would have scraggly, ugly hair.
I'm not talking about bad hygiene or anything, but just,
well, it's all part of the same thing.
More of an anarchic approach to what a good nose is, or what fashion is, or what good lips are.
Fashion has been with us ever since time began, people have been wearing beads around their necks and chains around their ankles and frisky grass skirts around their waists. And it's a way of expressing yourself. It's quite creative. It's also a way of attracting the opposite sex. If we all went around in little white uniforms, it would be a pretty uninteresting world. We'd all look just alike. It's a way of calling attention to yourself and saying, look at me, I'm special.
Helen Gurley Brown is my guest, if you're just joining us. She's been the editor of Cosmopolitan for the past 17 years and is now the author of a new book called Having It All. Now, you, for years, have been editing a magazine that is devoted in part to fashion. Have you ever had, since you think of yourself as not perfectly fitting that image, which is why you've had to make changes or you've wanted to make changes in your facial structure, have you ever thought of subverting some of that through the magazine, of using the magazine to help change that image a little bit so that you, as you were, would have been
okay,
more acceptable?
I'm so inured to doing it the other way that I have no wish to change society so that we're all acceptable in our present state. Because, as I have mentioned before, I think the fight, the challenge, is quite rewarding. It gives you something to do. Let me give you an example. I exercise an hour a day, and I'm trim. I'm in pretty good shape, and nothing is sagging or folding over. When you do the pinch test, you can't get hold of 4 inches of flesh, blah, blah, blah. Well, now that I've found out that a great many hundreds of thousands of other people are doing the same thing, that almost takes away some of the pleasure for me, because it was wonderful when I was one of the few people who was doing it. Now everybody is doing it. I don't know whether I'm making my point, but if you take away this ability, this way of becoming special and different, it's as though they were taking something away from you. I don't want to look like everybody else. I don't want to have my cosmetics confiscated. I don't want to be told that it's okay to be fat.
But this is the kind of mixed message that a lot of people feel you get from the fashion industry. On the one hand, there's this message to be individualistic and be yourself. Don't be a sheep and follow the crowd. On the other hand, be fashionable. Make sure your nose is the right shape. Make sure your lipstick's the right shade. Make sure you don't have wrinkles, even if you're getting older. So you're told to be an individual and not conform, but you're also told exactly what you're supposed to look like.
Terry, all of these are individual choices, and there are hundreds of thousands of women who don't want to sign up and join up and follow fashion, and that is perfectly fine. They're marvelous women, and they're some of my best friends. I don't know about yours, and I've written a whole chapter in Having It All about the fact that nobody has got a gun to your head telling you to do these things, and we don't do it in Cosmo either. But I must reiterate, it's pleasurable. It's exciting. I love all my little closies. I couldn't, and my husband is going to kill me for saying closies, footsies, kneesies, or anything. He thinks that's very inappropriate at my age and station to describe things with an IES at the end of the word. Nevertheless, I love my little closies when I go into the closet and look at them. And I always did when I was a secretary, when I was a clerk, when I was going to high school. Clothes are pretty, and they're fun, and they're interesting, and no, it isn't who you are, and no, it isn't what you are, but it's one of life's pleasures. Why denigrate that? Why rule it out of your life? It's okay if you want to. I can't decide for you, but I find following fashion rather interesting, and the fact that the hems have to go down 1 year and come back up the next year, and they forgot turquoise altogether for 7 years, and now it's okay to wear turquoise. I don't live by those precepts. On the other hand, I find them interesting. You either sign up or you don't.
Helen Gurley Brown is my guest, and a lot of our listeners know you not only for your new book and for being the editor of Cosmo, but also for your earlier book, Sex and the Single Girl. One of the chapters in your new book, Having It All, is about sex in the office and what kinds of rules or suggestions or things to keep in mind one should have. What are your suggestions about whether or not it's okay to have an affair with someone you work with?
Well, first of all, I don't think you can keep sex out of an office, because there are a lot of men there and there are a lot of women there, and we are all sexual creatures before anything else, probably. So sex is there, whether you try to rule it out or not. I have found that it's not a thing that doesn't have to. Let me see how many adverbs and verbs I can get into this one sentence. I have found that sex is not a bad thing to have in an office because it motivates people to do their very best when you are interested in a man in your office. You probably are coming on at your professional best. It doesn't mean you're hanging around his desk and putting on your lipstick and flirting. It's just that men and women in offices, I think, do better work because they are aware of each other as sexual human beings as well as professional teammates. So that's number one. Sex in an office generally is okay. In terms of having affairs with people you work with, I can't see anything wrong with that. That's where you meet a lot of your friends. After all, we work 8, 10, some of us 12 hours a day. That's where most of your contacts are made. I don't think it's the end of the business. It's not the end of the business relationship. And I've never worked in an office in which I wasn't involved with somebody except at Cosmo. I've been married ever since I've been at Cosmo. But I feel too much is said about stamping out romantic relationships in an office. You don't conduct them during your working hours, but it's okay to meet people there.
What about when that relationship ends and there you are in the same office with that person who you've just ended an affair with every day and you've got to work together, and then work ceases to be a place where you can get away from the pain of that ended relationship?
That's something to consider, except, again, I always use myself as an example, and you just don't see so much of that person. They may be in one wing of the building, you're in another. I certainly don't think you have to pick up and leave and go to another company just because the affair has ended. It's just not the end of the world.
Because of your attitude about sex in the office and because of your books, do people assume that you're anxious to sleep with everybody who you work with?
Terry, I've been married successfully, I would say, for 23 years, and I'm not 21 years old any longer. So the last thing I want is for people to assume that I'm a sex-crazed, strange, older woman. That would be really ugly. It's just that I think sex is such a wonderful force. It should be in your life. I certainly encourage the people who work with me at Cosmo to like each other if affairs are conducted by people who work together. That's fine. Unfortunately, there are too few men at Cosmo. We need a few more to make it equitable. But I'm not apologetic for thinking that sex is terrific and hoping that my readers will have it in their lives, because it's something like fashion, like breathing, like food, like being warm, like loving friendships. It's a pleasurable thing that you want not to be deprived of.
Would you be comfortable with a lesbian affair in the office?
Of course, of course. Gracious, what a question. My goodness.
Just checking.
Okay.
Do you believe in monogamy?
I believe in monogamy for me, and I certainly believe in monogamy for my husband. But believe in monogamy, I think when you're a single woman, which I was until I was 37, you need a network of friends, and there isn't always one wonderful man with whom to have a fabulous relationship. And I think married men can easily be in the life of a single woman, and it is not the end of his world or your world. You can go to lunch, you can go to dinner, and you can have married men friends. If there's anything I don't like in life, it's a married couple who shut everybody else out. And when you even have dinner with them, you feel you're encroaching because they are so into each other. Who needs the rest of the world? They make me very nervous. I hope David Brown is faithful. I don't know. I know I'm faithful. For me, it works, but I really can't put down the ground rules for anybody else on that one.
The cover of a magazine is maybe the most important part of it, because it's what people see when it's in the drugstore or on the newsstand. How do you choose what the cover is going to be for Cosmo each month?
We have a format, really. The woman is very beautiful, and she's very feminine, and she's wearing pretty clothes. The photographer, French photographer Francesco Scavullo has done our covers for the last 16 years, and I let him pick the models. He keeps track of who's coming on, who's beautiful, who's ready to be photographed, and he does all that styling. My husband, whom I mentioned earlier, David Brown, writes all the cover blurbs, the little lines on the cover which tell about the articles. That is very important. The cover is serious, but then finally it's the product inside that keeps people coming back to you month after month and year after year.
What have been some of the best-selling covers in the 17 years you've been editor?
You see, Terry, that isn't a question that's answerable because, if I may, Cosmo's sales have gone straight up every month for 17 years, one month more than that same month of the year before, except in 1981 when we began to have a depression and Cosmo's sales leveled a bit. We didn't go up that year, but now we're beginning to go up again. So that's 1 year out of 17, and I can't remember any outstanding covers or any outstanding issues, really. You put it all together, and it works. It's cumulative.
Sometimes when there's a very sexy-looking woman on a cover, people wonder if the cover is for women or for men.
Cosmo is such a woman's magazine. It's definitely edited for women, and I dare say men enjoy looking at the cover. I hope they do, but the magazine is definitely edited for women. I think women like to look at other pretty women. I certainly do.
How has the nature of the kinds of articles that you'll include in Cosmo changed in the past 17 years?
It really hasn't. We've always dealt with emotions. Emotions don't change. They haven't for thousands of years. Love, hate, greed, envy, jealousy, ambition, those remain the same. The articles are matched up to those emotions, but what we do is keep track of what's going on out there. In the newest issue of Cosmo that's just on the stands now, we have a major article on female infidelity. We are not for it or against it. We're just reporting about it, and that is a very it's not a new phenomenon, but it certainly has increasing numbers of people participating. So the articles keep track of what's going on in the world. There's another article about fear of ambition. I don't see how we can still be afraid of success at this stage of the game, but some of us are. Not me. I think it's terrific. But some women are afraid to become successful in the professional sense of the word because they're frightened they'll be too masculine or they'll be too aggressive and people won't like them anymore. So that's the kind of article we would be doing now, this minute, because it's appropriate.
How do you see yourself and how do you see the magazine in relation to feminism?
I am a feminist, and Cosmopolitan is a feminist magazine. We predated the woman's liberation movement because since 1965 we have been saying men are marvelous. You want one in your life if possible. At least you want somebody to love. And children are wonderful. If you want to be a mother, what could be more satisfying? But don't live through your husband and don't live through your children. Do something on your own. Achieve. Be recognized for your own achievements. And we hit that theme every single month, and we have for 17 years. So that does indeed make us feminist. That is our message. Where one might think we part company from the feminists, both in the book I've written, Having It All, and in Cosmopolitan magazine, is that I do stress having a man in your life to love, and there are not enough men to go around, 13 million of us for every 10 million men. So you may have to be extra charming, extra attractive. You can't just be a little nothing burger. I think what is the term when this country was pioneer times, when there were so many more men than women. My gosh, all you had to do was get up in the morning and 15 men were waiting for you. They needed you to go in the wagon train or be their wives because the last one just died 15 minutes ago. That was then. Now we do it a little differently. There are not enough men.
Of course, the statistics are confusing, especially given the number of gay men and women now. You can't,
well, it's even
can't
worse
just balance
because,
it off
because
like that.
It would be even worse if we knew how many homosexual men there were who are really not available to us as sexual partners.
And probably lesbian women who don't really
but
care
not,
about the
they're
available
not as
men.
Many not as many lesbian women as there are homosexual men, if we've got our statistics straight.
I guess another place where you maybe part company with feminists is that I think many people, especially in feminist magazines, would say that it's not necessary for women to be too preoccupied or spending too much time wondering what they can possibly do to make themselves attractive to men, that they should be thinking more in terms of what goals they want for themselves and how they feel comfortable looking and
you
feel
see,
natural
you can
looking.
You can do both, and you must. You must think about your professional and work goals. Whatever work you're in, work and love, those are the two big things, and I think one is just as important as the other. Obviously, you must worry about your work life, but you don't have to do that 100% of the time. There is still time left over to worry and be concerned about your personal life. I think your personal life is not wonderful unless you have somebody in it to share it with you, hopefully a sexual partner, but if not, some kind of partner. And that takes a little doing, especially when you get into your 40s and 50s. And you must make the effort to meet men, and having met them, it doesn't hurt to know how to get along with them. And I have no compunction about giving advice along that lines. The stuff that worked for me, you know, like being a good listener, and except this morning when, or this afternoon when I'm doing all the talking, but usually it helps to listen. That is one way to endear yourself to anyone. And it helps to like men. There are a great many women who want men in their lives, but I don't think they really are compassionate about men. I don't think they're worried about whether men are happy or comfortable or healthy or anything else. That would be considered exploiting a man to have one of them just because you need him. So you have to spend some time thinking about those things.
Your new book is called Having It All. Do you think of yourself as someone who has it all?
I have my all, or most of it, and it would not necessarily be somebody else's all. For me, having good work to do and being rewarded for it has worked out wonderfully well for me, and I have a good husband, so I've got the work and the love. I don't have children. I didn't want children. That's a very odd thing to say, but I just never had a great maternal drive. I had an invalid sister whom I was responsible for from the time that I was, I don't know, 15 or 16 years old, and somehow she was my child for a long time, and I worked very hard to make things possible for us. I just didn't need a child. So back to the original thesis, my having it all is having a work life and a wonderful man. Somebody else's all would involve having children and working for the community and doing lots of other things. But all that matters is to get for yourself what's there, what's possible, to use your potential. That's the really big deal. Get it out of yourself. Don't just let it lie dormant.
It's unfair for me to ask you this question in the minute that we have remaining, but I'm sure when you were deciding to not have children, a lot of people said, oh, you're going to regret it when you get older. Do you regret it? Or do you think you made the right choice?
I was older when I got married.
Good point.
This is the true truth. I have never regretted it, ever, not one moment.
Thanks so much for talking with us. Really, I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. I have too.